Hi, this is Tessa from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This talk was recorded live at DFTB 18. Enjoy the show.
Like the doctor because he had the same name as me and he looked at my Minecraft books. But I was bored in the waiting room because the TV was stuck on CBeebies.
Thank you for looking after me.
Finny, tell me about your blood test that you had.
It's not very nice because there was a pin in me and it was really sharp and I really didn't like it.
The doctor didn't say hello to me.
Mom, my leg hurts.
I know, but they'll be here soon to give you some medicine, okay?
Mom, my leg really hurts.
I know, darling. You're being so brave. It won't be much longer, I promise.
I didn't know who he was.
I'd like you to close your eyes. Seriously, please do close your eyes. I'm not going to chuck anything at you. This isn't a test. And I'd like you to imagine your place of work when it's really busy. So that can be the emergency department, the assessment unit, maybe it's a ward, maybe it's a busy clinic. And I want you to think about what you're experiencing when it's really busy. It's likely to be distractible, loud, maybe a bit chaotic. And why is that? What is the underlying reason for you feeling a little pressured? And is it because you're doing a procedure? Well, that's unlikely. When we put a cannula in a child, we don't normally kind of start speaking out loud or making a noise, even with our most sick patients during a resuscitation. It should be orderly, not particularly chaotic. There should be a few leaders giving a few verbal commands. So what makes this buzz in the background? Well, it's communication. It's communication between people, people talking, people laughing, people crying, people maybe getting upset, people maybe rejoicing. But all these things lead to a background buzz. Some of these aren't even from humans. Maybe it's an alarm going off or a tannoy buzzing or the phone ringing. Ultimately, though, on the really busy days that you have, they're not quiet, i.e. auditory quiet shifts. Right, you can open your eyes now. So communication is a core component of medicine. Communication is a core component of this conference. We're here to celebrate science and story. What brings science and story together is communication. But it's interesting, isn't it? We talk a lot about communication being fundamental to everything, and yet we talk about communication problems as happening to other people or other things. And we actually rarely look at the communication problems we may have. So I was invited to talk about dealing with communication difficulties in children, but I'm not going to talk about that because that's not the problem. The problem is my or your communication with children with communication difficulties, because I think that's the real challenge that we have. And it is a complex area, and there's lots of components to communication. There's visual communication. I can adopt a very angry posture, or I can be subdued and hide away, and they are both forms of communication. There's verbal communication in terms of the tone of voice that you use, and then there's the communication of words. And then of silence, which can be a communication mechanism all of its own. And these things interact. They're not independent variables. A problem in one area can lead to a problem in the other, and they're not ubiquitous. Just because you're a child with a severe communication difficulty doesn't mean that you don't have aspects of some communication. And there's lots of people in this room, I suspect, have communication difficulties as well, maybe in some one form or another. It's August in the United Kingdom at the moment, and August is the time of transition. We have medical students becoming junior doctors, and we have junior doctors doing pediatrics for the first time. And they're keen, they want to get involved. and they'll take histories from families and they'll do examinations, and they might not be very good at it, but they will try hard and they will get results. They will get the history from a family. They'll chase the four-year-old around the room and they'll do some kind of examination and they'll probably get some clinical findings. But what always interests me is that when they come to present in the first couple of weeks, they give the story, they give what they think the diagnosis is, and then I'll ask, well, what does mum or dad feel about that? If we're going to send them home, are they going to be happy or sad? Are they going to be relieved? And you get a completely blank look. And they've not considered that at all. They've not read the body language of the mother or father. They've not picked up on aggressive or angry tones. And it's something that they will learn during the course of their 4, 6 months, a year with us. We will teach how you recognize these features in parents and that these are important safety nets. Yes, a child might have a completely normal set of observations, a normal blood test, but actually it might be a parental gut feeling that comes out through communication that saves that child's life. But these are all things that we can teach. But what happens if you have a deficit in those fundamental parts of communication where you can't read other people's emotions? What happens if you don't get anguished about not being able to read anguish in others? Because there are children and adults out there who have a great deal of difficulty reading other people's emotions, and that leads to a great deal of communication difficulty. And this is a challenge for all of us. So I want to take you on a little story. We have Sam. Sam is 8 years old, and Sam has been described as having autistic spectrum disorder. Spectrum is an interesting word, isn't it? Because it kind of describes a scale from minor to severe. But the patients I meet and the parents and carers I speak to don't really like spectrum because it means that there's a scale and that the child should be somewhere on that scale. And actually, most children are unique, and that they have some facets of their behavior which are sometimes challenging and sometimes not. But poor Sam is presented, and he's described at in the assessment cubicle as being aggressive when he gets a bit upset. And there's only a few people can handle him, his parents and his carers. And I know he's aggressive when he gets upset, because lots of people mention that. It seems to be the only handover that you get in the emergency department when you get a child with this type of problem occurring. It's the only thing people talk about. And I think that's quite unfair on Sam, because he has a lot of positive attributes as well. But Sam at home, he got into the kitchen and he accidentally got hold of a knife and he's cut his hand open. He's got quite a deep laceration to the palmar aspect of his hand. But he's holding his hand closed. But it's clearly actively bleeding. So we're left with a young boy who is known to have some communication and behavioral issues with an injury. And the educator might go, well, how do you solve this problem? And I think that's where our problem begins, because we've framed it in completely the wrong way. The question the educator needs to ask is, how can we communicate effectively with Sam to solve Sam's problem? And it's that frame that I think will help us look at this problem in a more constructive way. And I'm not an expert in terms of dealing with these cases, and I will acknowledge now that there's lots of different ways of doing this. My approach might be good, it might be bad. There will be lots of people in this room who probably have better approaches than me, but I'm just going to give you a sense of what I think some of the key components are in dealing with this particular issue. And the first of those is what psychiatrists call theory of mind. So theory of mind means that that person has a very fixed way of dealing with the world. They are sometimes described as being stubborn. That's really unfair. They're not stubborn. They just have a different view of the way the world works than I do. But it's important to realize that, because it may be that you ask Sam on a number of occasions to open his hand. But Sam heard you the first time, and he's decided in his mind he's not going to open his hand. So you can ask him again. You can ask him 4 times, 5 times, 6 times. We can get up to 30 times of asking Sam to open his hand, but he heard you the first time and he's not going to open his hand. And he's just as defiant about it at time 30 that he was at time 1. And it's important that you people appreciate that. The second thing is about control. The current president of the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health is Russell Viner. He happened to be, was an Australian, or I suppose still is, just happens to be in the UK. And Russell talks about control being a medical construct, a medical measure, as it were, but actually control is an emotion. If you have a young teenager who may have behavioral difficulties as a result of a mental health issue, they may have some very maladaptive behaviors, but those maladaptive behaviors keep them in control. And as doctors and nurses, we're taught you must take control of the situation. But in fact, in these situations, that's not the thing you need to do. You don't need control. What you need is to give that child or young person a bit of control back, because actually that's what they're desperate for and that's what they're crying out for. And then the final thing is thinking about communication as a linear entity. So you and I are used to dealing with two-way communication. Some of these children have never really experienced or understand two-way communication. It's something that is just not being possible for them or their parents or carers to deliver. And what that means is you might witness some very interesting interactions between the child and their parent and the carer, and you need to acknowledge that and take them on board. It's very easy to get judgmental with the way families treat their children. But that just might be because the communication construct is very different from what you're used to dealing with. There are some positive things that you can do. One of the things that people forget about is the need to continually reintroduce yourself. So I've just told you, don't repeat the task. But actually, when I go and meet someone at a conference for the first time, we'll introduce ourselves, we'll say our names, but I won't every time I speak say, oh, I'm Damien again, because that's because the person I'm speaking to knows that I've introduced myself. Some children with communication problems won't recognize that the conversation has ended and started, and you may need to begin again with that introduction. The second thing is a chap called Kenneth Nunn, who is a psychiatrist in Sydney, talks about the importance of logic. And actually, some of these children can be extremely logical, but to the extent where they will misinterpret things that you take for granted. So if you walk into the room and say, "Hi, Sam, I'm going to give you some pain relief," that's not particularly helpful to Sam. Pain relief for what and where? What you need to do is explain, "Actually, Sam, we're going to give you something to take away the pain in your hand." And that sounds a little kind of full-on, but is a logical approach to the problem that that child has encountered. Now, I'm not going to stand here and suggest a variety of different techniques, in particular for being able to sort out Sam's hand problem. I would recommend that there is good conversations with the family. Play therapists are also useful. Is there any way that anyone can get a quick look just to determine, is this something that needs suturing, is theatre required, or is this something that can heal? But one of the things that often happens in this situation is that there is decision paralysis because of the concerns about the communication difficulty. It's a really odd thing to do. Child presents, someone waves this red flag about how they might get aggressive or out of hand, and so what happens is the child gets left in a cubicle and people go away to make a plan. And for plan, what I read for that is code, well, I don't want to deal with this. And people are scared about a child escalating their behavior, so we leave them in a cubicle for 1, 2, 3 hours while they sit there. And lo and behold, after 2 and 3 hours of getting bored and angry, their behavior suddenly escalates. And this decision paralysis is something that we need to get over. Some of these children need prioritizing in exactly the same way you would do a testicular torsion or sepsis. And it's important to get a move on. Also, some of their escalating behaviors follow a sequence. So we know that there may be triggers. Those triggers are things like pain, things like hunger, things like tiredness. Some of these we can solve, some of them we can't. The triggers themselves also may be related to the parents. The parents may know what kind of kicks that child off. It may well be that one of the parents is a trigger themselves, and that needs to be acknowledged. And I thoroughly recommend you look up blogs by Yvonne Newbold, who is a parent who has a son with a number of disabilities, and she describes quite bravely some of the challenges that she faces. After the trigger event, there is an escalation period. Sometimes that child may exhibit some change in behaviours. If Sam was sitting in the corner and then suddenly starts standing up and wandering around, we may find that is a precedent or a precedent before something else may occur. Or Sam may then just sit down again. Or it may be that he suddenly starts becoming very angry, escalates and goes into a crisis phase. And that crisis phase may be verbal, or it may be physical aggression towards staff, himself, or other members of his family. After that, you might get a bit of a recovery, and this is often where mistakes are made, is that children with these communication challenges who get themselves into a real tiz then work into a recovery phase, and people think, it's okay. What we'll do now is we'll move his room, or now we'll do the intervention, and actually the recovery phase then just suddenly slips back into crisis, and you're back where you started again. So when we are thinking about how we deal with these particular issues, there is no hard and fast rule. There is no ABC in terms of communication cascading. There is no magic bullet. There's no one medication that is going to solve the child's issues or will solve what is perceived to be your particular problems in dealing with the child. So I'd like you to leave you with a frame of reference, is that when it comes to dealing with children with communication challenges, from their point of view, you're the one with the communication difficulty. And if you enter the particular pattern of the dialogue or engagement with the family with that frame of mind, I think the eventual overall outcome will be much better for the child, for the family, and for yourselves. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I think people are a little bit in a sugar coma after their ice blocks because we're not getting that many questions through. So I'm going to ask a question. Do you actually think the number one thing we should do when it's been flagged that a child has a communication problem, before we even go into the cubicle, is ask their parents what's the best mode of communication, or is there, are we better to sit or stand, or is there a topic that the child particularly likes? You know, is that the best starting point?
So the key is, in my experience, these families are not going to choose to come to hospital for no reason. They know that there are going to be difficulties. So they are prepped with a number of things they will tell the staff at the outset, which hopefully will include a number of things that can be used to help deal with that child. What is sad is out of that dialogue, often the only thing that gets brought forward is if Sam gets a bit upset, he gets aggressive, rather than the list of things that actually Sam needs. And a personal care plan, I think, is useful for each child. It's useful for parents to go through and have a sheet as this is what Sam's particular preferences are, this is what he likes and this is what he doesn't, because that's something physical that the families can give to staff that can go in the notes and that everyone has instant awareness of.
I'd
open up the floor.
My other question is, if you have a question, welcome to the microphone. My other question is that given that we know these children do have a range of complexities, and somewhat times in my experience what brings them into the ED department is parents at their wit's end, do you think it's wise that sometimes we ask parents outside of the room with the child if mum or dad is clearly escalated? Because I have also had it where, you know, a very well-intentioned health professional will say, what's brought you here? And they're like, we're thinking about giving this child up. Not a good thing for a child to hear.
So I think there is a real challenge with understanding the dynamic of a particular family and broaching that in a way that is without judgment and doesn't appear that you are prying. It is clear to me that there are two different cohorts of patients. There's a child who presents with a particular incident, i.e. they've had an injury or maybe they're ill, that is a natural precipitant, or their behaviour may have escalated because of chronic difficulties. And that second group can be very challenging because often the their escalation involves in some way the way the parents or carers are managing the child. And that's a very difficult discussion to have in real time in front of the family. And you need to judge quite quickly what the child's understanding is. As you've alluded to, you don't want to make that situation worse by publicly playing out the fact that there may be some difficulties in caring. At the same time, without addressing that at all, you're not doing the family any service. Which is why I feel a bit of a fraud, because I've not offered any of you any solutions to this at all. And I've struggled with this for a long time on the talk. But my personal belief is this isn't one size fits all. Mm. It's about everyone having some common principles and problems they're aware of.
Mm. Do you have anything? Oh, we have a question. Thank you. Oh, we're not on.
The major way we deal with patients is by ward rounds, which is probably the worst possible way to communicate with anybody. Can you give some suggestions to the assorted group as to how we could do our ward rounds better than what we already do?
Oh, that's a good question. So I will... one of the things we have traditionally taken... we've gone to the bedside on ward rounds. That's a model that's existed for a long time. It may be that for some particular types of patient that might not work, and bringing the family and the child to a different area and having a different group of people around the child might help. Certainly, trudging around with a whole team of medical staff and then lots of medical students behind you, I don't think is the best way of approaching a child who is already particularly maybe distressed and frightened. The other thing about ward rounds, I think, is that, especially in the ED, and this is my personal experience, is that these type of patients, especially if they've had an escalation of behaviour and are needing rehousing or a mental health review, get stuck in the department for a considerable period of time, and you end up, they get completely ignored. So the ward round never happens because they're a patient felt to be, well, they've got this going on, it's not really my problem, we're going to leave them longer and longer, and their needs never get addressed. And I think that makes the problem even worse.
Thank you very much. On a difficult topic, can you please welcome me in thanking you for staying.